Welcome to the McCarthy Report, the podcast where I, Rich Lowry, discuss with Andy McCarthy the latest legal and national security issues. This week, what else? The latest on the January 6th committee. You are, of course, listening to a National View podcast. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And please give this podcast and Andy McCarthy the glowing, indeed gushing, five-star reviews they deserve on iTunes. And now, without further ado, I welcome to this very podcast through the miracle of Zoom, none other than Andy McCarthy.
Rich, how are you?
Good, Andy. So we got a lot of January 6th action. We want to dive into.
I'm looking around for David Bonson, though. I was driving around the other day, and so I was listening to the commentary podcast, and there was David on with J-Pod and the guys, right? And then I switched over to the editors last night. There he was again. Like, David is everywhere.
Ubiquitous.
We need more David, so that's good. But geez.
All right. So your hot take, I think it is a pretty hot take. All your takes are hot, Andy. I shouldn't discriminate. But this particularly hot one, basically that Liz Cheney is winning. Not that she's winning politically in terms of her own career. She's probably going to lose that. I think she'd get crushed in her primary, but probably lose. But you think that she's winning in terms of her purposes and this whole venture with this committee in the first place. So what do you mean?
Yeah, I think, Rich, that hidden under all of this, there's actually been, for all this projection of unanimity and bipartisan comity and all that jazz, Liz and the Democrats on the committee, I think, are in complete agreement regarding contempt for Trump and in complete agreement about the importance of keeping Trump relevant and in the public eye. But I think they're trying to accomplish two different things on that. And that's where the divide is. And I think she's winning. And the reason is, I think her objective was, for the first time since January 6th, even though we all know what the basic story is, and even though I think that the hearings are providing some intriguing granular detail, but really haven't changed the basic story, what she was hoping to get, I think, was a big national spotlight where, in a fairly short, tight, compelling way, she could show the various different ways that January 6th and everything leading up to it was so horrific that you couldn't conceivably nominate Trump again to be president. I mean, she'd like to see him prosecuted. She would have liked to seen him impeached. But at a minimum, I think she's trying to get him to so sully him that he's not a plausible presidential candidate, and that the Republicans realize he's not a plausible candidate. And therefore, because he can't win a national election that we would have to win in 2024 to try to right the country, that they have to look elsewhere. And I think that's really the bottom line minimum of what she wants to accomplish. And I think, by contrast, the Democrats want Trump front and center for the obvious reason that it takes – Trump is such a bigger-than-life figure, and he's so easy to goad that they figured that getting him front and center deflects attention from Biden and all the failure of Biden's administration. Number one, that's the immediate thing. But number two, I think they really want to run against him. I think they think that they have this terrible problem that you guys have on the editors have diagnosed very well, I think, which is they have Biden and Harris, and neither one of them is an attractive choice, but there's no obvious way to get rid of them. Now, I'm not as convinced as some people are that they can't and that there's not a third way. I think there is a third way, but let's leave that on the side. That's for another day. The point is, they have a big problem with Biden and Harris, and Trump solves the problem for them, because if they can run against him, I think either of them can beat him. And therefore, they'd like to get him out. They want to goad him into running. They'd love to get him to announce as soon as possible that he's running. And I think that's their objective. And I think if you look at it in that way, that those are the two competing objectives for these people who ostensibly agree on how contemptible Trump is, that Liz is winning.
So let's go through the hearings here. We obviously have the primetime overview. Benny Thompson is just not, he's not good at this. I don't know nothing about him. Maybe he's a fantastic behind the scenes player, but he's not a public communicator. And if you were trying to reach anyone who's persuadable doing all this KKK analogies and stuff, that wasn't doing. Whereas Liz, actually, she, whatever you think of what she's trying to do and whether she's succeeding, she knows what she's about. She knows how to make a case. Her opening statement was quite compelling. So what did you think of the first night?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I have a lot of criticisms of the committee, principally the lack of cross-examination. And I think it was really a terrible error on their part not to include these pro-Trump Republicans, because it wouldn't have changed. Jim Jordan wouldn't have been able to lay a glove on, you know, Bill Barr or Mike Luttig or Greg Jacob or these officers who testified so compellingly. So I think, you know, it's like a trial where, you know, even if they're terrorists, we give them lawyers, right? We let them make their case. I think, you know, that's what makes the proceeding have integrity and makes everybody think it was a fair fight. So I think the committee really undermined its purpose by not being structured that way. And it's undermined, I think, what Liz Cheney is trying to do in terms of getting, you know, reaching people. A lot of people in the country have made up their mind about Trump. I think most people in the country have. But like in terms of reaching the people she wants to reach, it would have helped to have a better structured committee. Of course, if they had had that, maybe she wouldn't have been on it. So that, you know, that's there's that trade off, too. But that having been said, with those, you know, those criticisms in the air and they don't go away, I think she did do what lawyers try to accomplish in the beginning of a trial, which is she gave a roadmap in a compelling story type way of what the evidence that she plans to present over the next, you know, six or seven hearings was going to show. We always say this is like trite, but it's kind of the package when a prosecutor does an opening statement. We always tell the jury that the opening statement is like the box that a jigsaw puzzle comes in. It shows you what the completed picture is going to look like before you start to hear the evidence and try to assemble it together. So I think it's a good story. The problem is I don't think it's true entirely. That is to say, her theory is that Trump has a 7-part plan to overturn the election. And her idea behind it is that there's a lot more thoughtful planning going on than what I suspect, which is, you know, understanding who Trump is. I've never thought Trump was incapable of thoughtful planning. I just think he's too impulsive and too undisciplined to stay on a plan. Mm-hmm. And I think that because he's more cunning than he is clever, that a lot of these plans aren't that well thought out in the first place. So there's a lot of ways for things to go wrong along the way. So Liz is trying to present this as if it was a conspiracy with multiple objectives and that it was a well thought out plan. And I think that's, you know, we always talk, Rich, in this podcast in various different ways. You've let me make this point a million times, that prosecutors should never overpromise. Mm-hmm. That, you know, you don't need to prove that this was an organized plan. I think what you need to prove is he may have committed a crime and that it was sinister. To attribute to him, you know, this organizational wizardry where this was really, you know, well thought out from the start, even though if you look at every individual aspect of it, it's cockamamie. Like somehow there was a brilliant genius who was behind sewing all this together. But when you look at every individual piece of it, it's like idiotic. You know, I think that's a stretch and I don't think she has to make it. And a cynical person would say, especially after watching the way this is rolled out the first couple of days, that Benny Thompson and Liz seem to be anchoring the meetings, you know, the sessions every time. And there just happened to be 7 other members of the committee. Yeah. And Liz just happens to say that there's 7 aspects to this conspiracy. And so far, what we've seen is each different session is held, is controlled by one member of the committee. So, for example, Monday's session was Zoe Lofgren, and yesterday's session was Aguilar's first name? I can't remember, Steve, I think, or I can't remember. But so it looks to me like what's happening is, you know, they decided that we're going to pass out one aspect of each of this to each member of the committee so they can focus on that, which is, by the way, when trial teams often do this, if they, you know, you divide up, if you got three members on the team, you divide up the burden, and that's how you do it. So there's nothing wrong with doing it that way, but I don't, you know, you don't want to like reverse engineer that so that this becomes a seven-part plan because you got seven assignments to give out.
So let me ask you just that were kind of at a question having to do with format and presentation. So what in your mind accounts for, you know, Bill Barr was the star of the first hearing this week, but he didn't appear there. Chris Steigerwald was the live witness, and Chris is a very, you know, astute political analyst, but I don't know why he would be, you know, one of the few live witnesses before this committee when you have Bill Barr, who's incredibly compelling, was on the inside, has a story they want to hear and tell. So are they relying on the snippets of the deposition just because you can totally control that? And they're not, you know, people say, oh, this is very compelling TV. The snippets are terrible. You know, the camera angles are bad. You know, sometimes it's, you know, you can see everyone. Sometimes you can't, you know, so they're, at least in my TV feed, there are little interruptions in the, right, the video for some reason. So it's not. Roger Ailes would be, you know, just on pure production values, would turning over in his grave, would say it's horrible TV because production matters so much in TV. But why not have, you know, Bill Barr for 2 hours?
There's two reasons, Rich. One is for all the talk that we have had about how the committee is riding roughshod over norms, and there's a lot to be said for that. They are trying to abide by some norms, and there is a required interbranch deference between the legislature and the executive. So, for example, with somebody like Barr, they don't want to subpoena Barr, mm-hmm, right? Because he was an executive official of the Trump administration. There would be potential issues of executive privilege, of you know, Justice Department obligations, and all that sort of stuff. So if you don't want to subpoena somebody, then you got to negotiate the appearance, okay, right? They're playing kind of with the house money because they know that you don't want to force them to, you know, do anything. You're not in a position to force them to do anything that they don't want to do. And Bill may have been much more comfortable. You know, one of the things about being able to give a deposition in a comfortable lawyer's office is that you have your lawyers next to you and you can consult with them as it goes along. Frequently, for example, I used grand jury subpoenas when I was a prosecutor as a way to get people to come to my office and have a better conversation, because the trade-off is if I put them in the grand jury, they got to go, but they don't get to take their lawyer in with them. If they come to my office to talk with me and the agents, they get to have their lawyer sitting next to them the whole time. The lawyer can call time out and we can clarify. So I imagine that these witnesses who are not being called for live testimony, that a lot of that is going to be the result of the fact that Congress, this is a congressional committee that's mindful of the fact that it's on thin ice demanding information from these high executive officials who were close advisors to the president. So that's the first part. And then the second part is what I've been complaining about and what we've talked about ad nauseum, which is there's no cross-examination in this committee. There's no competing perspective in this committee. So yeah, I had an argument with somebody about this the other day who said, look, you know, Bill Barr's testimony wouldn't have been any different if Jim Jordan had been on the committee. And I pointed out, no, Barr's testimony would have been different, not because Barr would have testified differently about the things he was asked about, but because he would have been asked about other things that the committee doesn't want to get into, right? So because this is a one-sided committee, they are able to orchestrate appearances like, you know, just put the clips together from the depositions, and they don't have to worry about some other member of the committee saying, now, hold on here, I want Bill Barr in here because I got about five other things to ask him about that you haven't covered. So I think those are the two reasons.
So the hearing with Barr focused on the zany theories around the election. There was a lot of focus on Barr's statement that if Trump believed this stuff, he was detached from reality. We can come back to that when we talk a little bit about the permutations of a potential criminal charge and the Trump's state of mind. Then you have cancellation on Wednesday. There's some speculation, though, maybe they think the court is going to come down with Roe and we don't want to be competing. And then yesterday, we're recording Friday, as usual here, you have Judge Mike Luttig, who we were talking a little bit on the editors. I also don't quite understand maybe your point. You know, there's a limit to how many people he can subpoena. But to me, the star was Mark Short, and who we just saw video clips of. And Luttig is a tremendous jurist and a great patriot, but wasn't a compelling witness. And this Pence counsel, Greg Jacob, who I thought he did testify live and was really quite compelling. And just going into detail about, how this Eastman theory, they all thought it was wrong. There's indications that Eastman thought it was wrong or incredibly adventurous, and just the pressure on them, on Pence, just never stopped. Literally, there was a riot going on and Trump hadn't stopped to make him bend to this idea that he could have somehow materially affected the counting of the electoral votes.
Yeah. See, I think you have to watch this on two tracks. I agree with everything you said about the nature of the witnesses. Again, I think Jacob probably could have cut this deal if he wanted to also. But with Short, he was, he was Pence's guy, right? So it's kind of like, remember the 9/11 commission trying to negotiate an appearance with Cheney and Bush? You can't subpoena high executive officials. So if they're willing to cooperate with you, you got to kind of take it on the conditions.
Did Bush talk to them?
Yeah, Cheney and Bush talked to them together. They didn't talk to them separately. And it was like a meeting in the White House where, I don't know if all the commissioners came or commissioners and staff, but they sat down and had an informal, not under oath, not under subpoena, all the things that suggest that this is interbranch comity where neither one is pressing the constitutional issue. Can I force you to give me information? And they're cooperating. But if one side is not willing to force you to give them information, then they have to basically agree to your terms. So I think probably Short said, I want to be interviewed in my lawyer's office with my lawyer sitting there next to me. I'm not saying Short had anything to worry about, but that's just smart. I used to tell people who said, I didn't do anything wrong. I don't have to worry about, talking to the FBI and talking to the government. Mm-hmm. And I'd be like, if you're a criminal suspect and you're coming in to talk to me, you need a lawyer because I'm a lawyer. Right. You need someone to even the playing field. That's not an admission of guilt. That's just smart. Right. So I'm sure that's what Short wanted and the committee accommodated it. And evidently Jacob was willing to be to testify, and he probably had his reasons for that. And I think for Luttig, this gets to, I think when I say you have to watch this on two tracks, there's one thing here that's about storytelling. This is a television presentation to the country, right? They're telling a story. They want you to understand the story. And for that reason, it's got a narrative flavor and structure to it. But always going on, and you can never forget this, and maybe because I'm like the lawyer who tries to prove cases around here, I'm more conscious of this than the average person is, but they're also keeping their eye on the record. And they want to establish that Trump and others are guilty of a crime. So where they have to go, and this is going to be very controversial, I think, if this gets pushed, is at what point in time does a legal theory become so frivolous that you could say it crossed over into fraud?
Can I interrupt you there?
Yeah, of course.
So I was only half paying attention when this came across, but there's another guy. Was his name Eric? He was also on video, a long name that might have started with an S. I think he was in the White House counsel's office, maybe. But he had a statement where he was saying, he was talking to Eastman, I think it was, and his last thing was, and you better get an effing really good defense attorney. Right. And then they went to Eastman asking for a pardon. So anyway, this is to just underline the question. What would Eastman's legal vulnerability be being a very bad and motivated, in the worst sense, lawyer? Why would that be a crime?
Well, if he knew that what he was saying was not a legally viable argument and that he was just using the opportunity of the presidency and the fact that he was giving advice to the president because they wanted to get something that they didn't, you know, that they would have to swipe because mm-hmm. the election was not theirs rightly, then that's a fraud scheme, right? Mm-hmm. But if you're presenting something that even though you know it's a reach, you think that there's a legally colorable basis for it, then that's not fraud. That's an argument that you're entitled to make. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it's out there doesn't mean it's necessarily wrong. And one of the reasons here's another place, Rich, where it's problematic that the committee is so one-sided. Before this committee met yesterday, when I knew, you know, Jacob was going to be there and Judge Luttig was going to be there, one of the things I did was read about a 4,000 word defense that Eastman wrote that they published at Claremont, at the Claremont Review of Books.
I read that.
I think they're going to have a hell of a hard time proving a crime here. And mm-hmm. I say that as somebody who thinks his theory was cuckoo. But, you know, when you break down, a lot of times what happens with frivolous legal theories is a good lawyer, let's say you have a four-part legal theory, a good lawyer can make the four parts sound like, okay, well, that makes sense. Yeah, that's got some grounding in something that's sensible. Yep, I can see that. Step three, And then we get to step four. And when we put it all together, what it means is the vice president gets to pick who's the president. And then you say, what? Wait a minute. So I think you may have one of these situations where, you know, Eastman, who's a very clever guy and knows a lot about the Constitution. And I think, unfortunately, here is, I think he's one of these guys who was kind of beguiled by Trump. And, mm-hmm. you know, this is a platform that he probably always thought he deserved because of his, work in the fields on constitutional law, et cetera. And, you know, he's another one of these guys who got a star turn with under Trump that he probably thought for years that he deserved in, you know, other circumstances. But he knows a lot about the Constitution. I mean, he taught the Constitution for a long time. And he's going to be able to come up with reasons why it was not fraudulent to make this argument. And then, of course, we know, Rich, that Trump jumps on this, right? The minute that somebody says we should propose legislation to change the Electoral Count Act, Trump comes running and says, see, all along, see, yeah, right. They all knew that it was that I was right. So the reason that you see Judge Luttig, even though he is not, as you say, the most compelling of witnesses in an oral presentation, he's a fabulous writer on the law. But the reason you see him there is it's almost, I want to say, moral authority. Like he was the one the day before January 6th, Rich, who put the hammer down. He puts out, you know, now, interesting interplay between the various characters here. Eastman clerked for Judge Luttig mm-hmm. on the Fourth Circuit. The questioning of Luttig yesterday was done by John Wood. Now, John Wood is not a member of Congress. But John Wood is a very prominent Republican lawyer, very tight with the Cheneys, was, you know, an important lawyer in the Bush administration. I think he had a big job at Homeland Security. He was a United States attorney. I think he represents like the Chamber of Commerce. He's a very prominent Republican lawyer, well known in Federalist Society circles, rock-ribbed conservative. But he also happens to have clerked for Judge Luttig. So it was interesting that he was the one who was chosen to pose the questions. Obviously, he's on the committee staff in order to project the idea of more bipartisanship, right? So Aguilar was the Democratic congressman who was running the hearing yesterday, but he turned over a lot of the questioning to Wood, particularly the training of Wood's old boss, Judge Luttig. And the questioning is about Eastman, who is, you know, someone who also clerked for Luttig and who they, you know, they both obviously know. And then the other interesting interplay for those who are, you know, big University of Chicago guys, both Jacob and Eastman went to the University of Chicago, and that came up at law school, and that came up in their exchanges about what was going on in the run up to January 6th. It's interesting. I think Liz Cheney also went to University of Chicago Law School. So there's a lot of interesting little connections here. But the thing is, Luttig is the guy who puts the hammer down on January 5th by putting out this tweet, which basically destroys Eastman's theory. Mm-hmm. And the reason it becomes important, it's not idle. There's clearly, there was communications going on between Pence's office and Judge Luttig. And I think that Judge Luttig, his authority as somebody who was a master of the Constitution and a respected federal judge, somebody who was talked about as a likely Supreme Court appointee during the Bush years, I think the idea is that that does two things. One, it explains what really stiffened Pence's spine when the big push from President Trump came, where Trump really leaned into him to try to get him to change his mind. But the other thing going on here, Rich, is Luttig is like the expert witness that Eastman's argument is worse than frivolous. I think the way he described it is it's wrong at every turn. So, you know, I think he's the guy who's like the anchor for now, at least, of the idea that this was worse than a frivolous legal theory. This was fraud.
So let's say he's right about that. How much does it matter if Eastman and then ultimately, more importantly, Trump genuinely believed that it was a stolen election? And they certainly seem to be, you know, they had great fervor about it. Trump still does today. And, you know, with Trump just disentangling what he really thinks and what he's just, how he's just trying to convince people of things after a lifetime of being able to bend reality to his will. I don't know how you do that.
Yeah. And Rich, this is the key question. And it's also why I think it would be a terrible idea to indict this case criminally. You know, first of all, and maybe I'm just like overly convinced after watching what happened to the country the last 8 years of Bill Barr's idea that if you're going to have the Justice Department intruded to politics and especially electoral politics, it better damn well be like a very clear crime that there's really compelling evidence about. Because if you're in these gray areas, then it always looks like it's political retribution. It always looks like a case you might not otherwise have brought. And it always therefore invites the other side to engage in its own retribution when inevitably they get into power. So Bill's idea was, and I think it's interesting that we're talking about this in the context of basically what one of the theories here is fraud on the government, right? Remember the last couple of weeks we were talking about the Sussman trial.
Yeah.
This, Rich, is exactly the charge that Durham wouldn't bring. You know, everybody on the Trump side, they're like pulling their hair out over what's wrong with Durham. Why doesn't he bring this fraud on the government charge against Hillary's campaign? Well, I have a feeling that those Trumpies who are very, you know, very upset with Durham are going to see the wisdom of his restraint as we go forward in this thing, because this is a difficult call. You'd have to show that that they knew to a fare thee well that they had no case and that this was just concocted, to give cover to what was a fraudulent effort to take the election. And I think, you know, Rich, there's like rhetorical fraud, there's civil fraud, and there's criminal fraud. I think we could all look at this and say this was crap. You know, this was just like Barr said, it was BS. But at the same time, say, yeah, but I don't know if I want to like indict it as a criminal offense where I have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt to 12 jurors, you know. And as you point out, with respect to criminal intent is complicated because, yes, you have to prove that the defendant subjectively believed what he was saying was not true, and is guilty, had an intent to deceive. But if you're dealing with sophisticated actors who can cover their intent with legal theories that may be on the fringe, but aren't necessarily, you know, completely, you know, concocted. And look, I read that Eastman thing. He talks about how, you know, a number of prominent legal scholars have believed for years that the Electoral Count Act is unconstitutional. And he goes through the different periods of time, different instances where vice presidents in Congress haven't complied completely with the Electoral Count Act. So there's a lot of precedent for that. I think you'd have a real hard time convicting them. And it would be wrong to intrude the Justice Department into politics in such a fraught way.
So we got to get you out here in 5 minutes. So you address the three realistic possible charges here. One is defrauding the government, which you were just discussing. You also have seditious conspiracy and conspiracy to obstruct Congress. And you think it's the latter that would be most likely and fruitful for their purposes?
Yeah, very quickly, I think on sedition, the problem that the committee has, and this is, again, you'd know this if there was cross-examination allowed, but the committee's theory of sedition is completely different from the Justice Department's. The Justice Department is trying to keep Trump a million miles away from their seditious conspiracy indictment.
Everyone's every idiot saying, oh, I came here at the behest of the president.
Right. I'm not making war on the United States. I'm defending the United States against these people who are trying to steal the election. So if you read the Justice Department indictments, Trump is a tangential figure. He's a pretext for violence that the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys would have engaged in anyway. And if you look at what the committee's theory is, Trump is the root of all evil. He's basically marshaling them. In Liz's opening statement, she said that, he assembled them and, you know, she's pitching it like he's given them direction. So they're going in opposite ways. Sedition's not going anywhere, Neil Catchall notwithstanding. But the real case here is, did they obstruct Congress? And the question with the obstruction statute is, anyone who corruptly impedes a congressional proceeding.
So how did he impede it? By attempting to have Pence impede it, or by a mob of his supporters showing up?
Well, according to, well, Liz says that's a multi-part plan, and I don't think she has to get there for the obstruction statute. Mm-hmm. They're relying heavily on the opinion of this judge in California who ordered Eastman to turn over his Trump emails. And that judge said that it was more probable than not that they had obstructed a congressional proceeding. Now, as I've pointed out, that's very different. That was in the context of an evidentiary issue where the only question is it more probable than not that the guy committed a crime? In a criminal trial, you would have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the guy had committed a crime. And people should remember, in the California case, Trump isn't even a party to that case. He doesn't have counsel. He doesn't get to
present. But the crime would be conspiring to have Pence do this, even though he didn't do it, or allegedly inciting the mob.
Yeah, Rich, is conspiring to stop Congress from doing something that it would otherwise be doing and was entitled to do. So the idea is they were trying to derail the counting of the executive, the electoral votes, which is what the January 6th joint session of Congress, which is required by the Constitution, is about.
So under this theory, would everyone every Republican who voted to object be an accessory to a crime?
Well, it depends on what their state of mind was, right? Did they really believe that this was not a frivolous legal position? Like, did Ted Cruz, when he got up and asked for the 10-day deferral or deferment, or, you know, that the survey, was that what he wanted? I forget what he, you know, did he know that that was a ridiculous legal argument? Did he know that it was so ridiculous that there was no legal founding for it at all, and therefore it was fraud? You know, I just don't think you should want to go there. And this is why. I know we're running out of time, so I would close with this. The reason that impeachment does not require a criminal offense is because what we're looking at in impeachment is, was this conduct unbecoming public officials? Did they violate their public trust? Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to look at all this and say this was a flagrant violation of the public trust. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, then say, but as a matter of individual justice, not political justice, but individual justice in a criminal court, can you prove beyond a reasonable doubt that these guys were corrupt and fraudulent rather than that they were out on the edge on a legal theory?
So we've got about another minute, and we'll obviously we'll have a lot more time to discuss this in coming weeks. But we asked in the editors last week, will Trump be indicted? I think we're all of us. No, it's not going to happen. Forget about it. But you think there's some substantial chance?
I think 6 chances in 10 he gets indicted.
Wow.
And I think the reason for this, Rich, is these hearings are going to have some impact in terms of changing the public mind. I've talked to people in the last week who are Trump people who've said, oh, my God, this was really terrible. So, Liz is right in the sense that if you show a compelling, compact presentation of this, it's capable of changing some minds. But the other thing, Rich, the reason we're having these hearings now is because Democrats think it's politically propitious for them to be deflecting from Biden now. And this Justice Department has shown a great propensity to give in to the left on a lot of things it should never have given in on. And the left really wants Trump to be indicted. They really want Trump to be indicted. And there's a lot of things the Biden administration is not going to be able to deliver them, but they can give them this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So on that point, on people being persuadable, we also discussed that on the editors a week or so ago. And I was like, this committee is not moving the needle at all. And NBD was like, no, I think it is moving it against Trump somewhat. And I now agree with that. And I think the definition of persuadable, you're not going to convince any Trump supporter that Trump did terrible things and should be indicted. But you might convince them, you know what, this is too much trouble. Why are we going to go through this again? And maybe they are, to your point, moving the needle on that metric.
Yeah, that's why I think Liz wins. I mean, I don't think he shouldn't be indicted. He won't be impeached, but he should never be nominated. And I think this makes it a lot more likely that he won't be.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have this week. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And thank you, Andy McCarthy.
Thanks, Rich.